You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH FM 101.9. I'm your host, Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore today. We're talking to Shinyi Pai, a Seattle poet and author of several books, including Enzo,
Ozarks,
Adamantine, Sightings, Equivalents, and her most recent one is Virga. From 2015 to 2017, she served as the fourth poet laureate of the city of Redmond, Washington. Her personal essays have appeared in City Arts, Tricycle, Seattle's Child, and Yes magazine. Shinyi received her MFA from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She's been a Stranger Genius Award nominee in literature and lives and works on the ancestral tribal lands of the Duwamish. Welcome, Shinyi.
Thank you, Steve, for hosting me.
You bet. Well, could we start with news of your death from Virga?
Sure. The news of your death reaches me in the morning. A building crew across the street pushes back their clamor for an extra hour. Rested, I rise to meet another day, stunned to see your face flooding the internet. Morning messages burying the story of what is known. You ended your life. 3 days after your body blackened in a car, you set ablaze by the rifle range. You were named in the local daily. I lost no sleep at the gossip of the Sakyong's sudden departure. Like father, like son, the harm that cannot be undone. What I can't get past the meaning in your last act of resistance, the vows we take as teaching, to do no harm, to do no harm, to do no harm.
So that was about an incident with a close friend of yours.
This was a very tragic incident that that happened to a person who was my meditation teacher in graduate school and a poetry friend, somebody who was very important to me when I was a young person.
There's another poem, and there's a video that goes with it called Embarkation. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the same year that you got this news. So could you talk a little bit about that and then read Embarkation?
Yeah, I don't remember if it was the same year that I experienced the loss of my friend and teacher, but the event of my friend's passing and his decision to end his life was very impactful on me, because this was somebody who had been there for me when I was beginning on my spiritual path towards committing to becoming a Buddhist and preparing to take vows of refuge. And so my friend Bill was somebody that I always associated with this time and period in my life in terms of the things that converged to help me to make that decision. So when he ended his life, that had a large impact on me in terms of, I think, leading me to revisit and consider what my spiritual path has been, who my teachers have been, and what teachings have and haven't really, I guess, been suitable to perhaps my sensibilities or who I am. So the other poem that you asked me about is a piece called Embarkation that I wrote, I think it was maybe like sometime in 2018, maybe, I can't remember, but the idea of embarkation, it came about because I had spent some time in my parents' native homeland of Taiwan and had the opportunity to travel to observe a traditional Taoist boat burning ceremony that takes place about every 3 years or so. And these particular ceremonies are meant as kind of ritual cleansings in some way. This community in Donggang, the seaside town in Taiwan, the community comes together and they take a year to build a life-size wooden boat that, instead of piloting on the waters, they actually march through the village and parade it through the town over several hours. And as night falls, they actually load it up with the broken dreams, illnesses, and misfortunes of the past years of all the residents and citizens. The people involved in this ritual then carry the boat out to the shore, to the beaches, where they moor it on basically like a bed of spirit paper or joss paper that is incinerated after midnight. And this, you know, very public ritual is very much, to my own mind, about helping a community to kind of let go of things that have been plaguing it and to kind of reset or to start anew. And carrying what I was at the time that I was traveling through Taiwan, I couldn't help but think of the loss that had occurred and the friend that I had lost. And so I wanted to create a video poem, a performance, a text piece that could be about taking this public or community-based ritual and reimagining it for the purpose of going through one's own personal grief ritual. So that's the origin of this poem, which, as I said, is also, it's existed as a performance and as a video piece. Embarkation. Butter lamp, incense stick, beeswax votive, the occasion of poem, rites I enact to set the world aglow with the light of desire, the fire of the mind. Adorned in the colors of the eight temples, the caretakers of the Wangye gods march through the streets of the seaside town. The lone envoy bearing a square yoke parades the wooden boat through narrow lanes until nightfall, when the barge is brought to rest upon a bed of joss paper. Earlier that night, men load the boat with handwritten wishes, the misfortunes and plague of the past year to be piloted up to the heavens in a blast of fireworks, deafening the crowd that came to bear witness to ceremony. We observe as each of us does, some of us bail out before a thing is done. To escape our ghosts, we watch it burn. I can't unsnarl the knot of unmet want, so I sever it in heat, draw the cord into flame to free myself from the clutch of haunting, to disembark at the latitude of where I give up the ship.
I found your description to be interesting. When I looked at the video, I thought, you know, gee, they're burning a fairly large vessel. So it's a ceremonial vessel, and so it's not built to be seaworthy or anything, right?
I believe it's absolutely capable of being seaworthy. It's built by traditional boat makers using the techniques that they've used for centuries. And it's simply that they opt to not sail it. They opt instead to burn it.
It had big sails on it. I was really struck by the video of that and the description of what it was there for. It's really quite a project. That's amazing. You did this as a collaboration with your friend who shot the video for your video presentation of the poem, right?
Well, the circumstances of how the project was made had a lot of different pieces. So at the time that I went to this boat burning festival, I traveled with my friend, the poet and filmmaker, Ye Mimi, who's very well known as a visual poet and filmmaker. And we had both known that we were interested in visiting this festival for anthropological purposes, really, as kind of observers of this ritual festival. And I know that I wanted to write about it and photograph it, and she knew that she wanted to take some footage. So we both went with that intention. After the festival, she didn't do anything with the footage itself. She had herself been going through some intense health issues and some spiritual crises that were afflicting her at the time. And I asked her if I could have the footage that she had made, and she shared it with me. And I also had a kind of bank of images that I had accumulated through, you know, still photography that I knew that I wanted to be part of the project as well. So once Mimi gave me that footage, I approached a friend of mine here in Seattle that I had worked with before on a video poem and animation project, a person named Scott Kiva James, who is somebody who does like a lot of video mapping and projection work. And I brought it to him and I said that I had a specific vision and idea for a piece that I wanted to make. And specifically, I was exploring at that time the idea of having a video projection that could accompany a performance that I was going to do on stage at the Moore Theater for Ampersand Live. And so the original incarnation of this project was that Scott edited and made and kind of stitched together a bunch of these images and still photographs that became the backdrop of a performance with images that were also projected onto my body. I was wearing a white paper dress that also had flames projected on it to create the evocation of my own body being incinerated along with this boat, basically. So it existed as, you know, a one-time performance. And after that, we discussed the idea of translating that experience into something that could live a little bit longer in the world as a video poem. So then I made a recording of the poem itself, and we talked about the ways in which the video could be reworked slightly for, you know, a non-performative kind of format, and that's what he ended up developing.
You have a number of video poems, and a lot of that was collaborative work too. So do you do any video editing yourself?
I don't do video editing. I do still photography, and I have an interest in moving images and have worked with collaborators across many different disciplines over the last 20 years, everything from composers to choreographers. And there are disciplines that I will probably never get an opportunity to learn because I have limited bandwidth and not a lot of interest in mastering certain kinds of skills. And so often I do gravitate towards different collaborators who have expertise and experience in some of the genres and techniques that I'm interested in exploring.
Do you shoot the video? You had your friend shoot the video in when you did Embarkation, but have you ever tried to bully a wave? Was that a collaborator who generated that video?
Yeah, in the case of the larger piece title, which includes four different poems and videos within it, including How to Bully a Wave, that was with my collaborator, David Ian Bickley, who lives in Ireland. And David is specifically a filmmaker. So over the years, he's captured a sort of bank of moving images that he uses as part of his own kind of archive and raw materials for pairing with different kinds of projects. So when we began our collaboration, you know, I had a conversation with him where I talked to him about some of the themes that he was exploring in his work to get a sense of where there might be overlaps naturally in our kind of work. And he talked specifically about being interested in water and tides and waves. And, you know, that was, you know, okay, you know, interesting to me. But then he got to talking more about an interest in Buddhist karma and the idea of cycles of, I don't know what you want to call it, what would be kind of a good way to talk about karma, you know, cause and effect in life and the ways in which your actions can manifest different kinds of consequences in the world, right? So he wanted to kind of layer these images of the ocean and waves with a narrative that could explore a character that was exploring and struggling with notions of karma. And that resonated for me a lot because at the time I was going through some very difficult health issues and actually needed to have a surgical procedure in order to address some precancerous issues and condition that I had. And so the moment right before he asked me to collaborate was, you know, this moment when I hadn't quite discovered that my life was going to take this trajectory. And so it became a very different kind of poem than I set out to write when I agreed to write for him or with him. In that, you know, I do write a lot about Buddhist and spiritual themes in my work, but grappling with this very topic of karma and consequence at a time when I didn't know if I was going to be okay, that definitely informed the shape of the poem and what it would become. So it is not, in fact, a poem about surfing or a relationship to waves in the way that maybe it would be deceptively simple, but is actually a relationship to these kinds of waves and cycles of karma and being able to stand up within them.
Well, maybe you should read that so that people know what we're talking about.
Sure. Yeah, and it's a four-part poem. So the entire sequence is called Tidal. Amnion. In the fluid of the womb before human life pushes outward, the memory is already etched with the residue of each past spark. In another life, I was mother. In another life, I was man. In another life, I was beggar. In another life, I was heir. In another life, I lived through war. In another life, I was betrayed. In another life, I believed in a god. In another life, I saved myself. In another life, my life was claimed by hunger. In another life, my life was stolen by disease. In another life, my life was taken by poverty. In another life, my life was ended by violence. In another life, I died childless. In another life, I died without a name. In another life, I died alone. In this being reborn, the amnemnesis of past actions, this awakening from dormancy. Eddie. Caught in the spiral of time, I circle swim through another lap. Advance one more spoke on the amaranthine wheel, the flip turn, a reversal of direction by the swimmer, who repels against the walls of an imaginary pool, not grasping that the lines and planes of this four-sided geometry has their limits beyond those boundaries. Open water, limitless sea. Plunge. If 60% of our bodies are made of water, does this account for why human beings float? If I think too hard, will I sink like a stone? If skin is the largest and most permeable organ of the body, who do I become when submerged in saline? If I experienced amnesia, would I have to learn how to crawl again? Do you prefer to be reborn as a woman, dolphin, or man? Through which channel do you hope to re-enter these tears? If I wish to take hold of water's meaning, what would permit me to take that plunge? Title. The ocean bulges toward the moon as wine decanted in a chalice flows over a rim. The coastal edge, a liquid boundary, the planet's flood tides guided by celestial mechanics. In the moon, the rise and fall of tidal surf, lunar phases pull gravitational forces, bring incoming storm surges. Orbital cycles of shedding, tsunami swells like scorched earth, wash away corporeal traces of calcium, sodium, phosphate, copper, and chloride, trappings, mineral and matter discharge. Have you ever tried to bully a wave? The roar of ocean drowns out all other voices until there is nothing but the crash of brine, the shanty that we are all invited to hum. Through the corner of my eye, I see it coming. Tally the seconds before waves' next full crest. Breathe through the break. Hold the deadlock of time within the body, knowing that motion is immaterial. Ease into the place where I can pull myself upright to standing, tides undulating beneath my cadence.
I didn't realize that those all were four parts of one poem when I'd seen all of that before, but I felt like those were things that could be read over more than once to really what you were going for. When you were going to undergraduate school, I got out of ENSO that you were studying Japanese culture while you were there. In Chicago. I don't totally understand exactly what you were doing, but it really intrigued me. Just talk about that a little bit, and then could you read Stillness?
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate studies at Boston University, and I minored in Eastern religion. And within that, I embarked on a pretty deep literary study of the convergence between literary arts and the sacred. So at the point where I was exploring the idea of going to graduate school after my undergraduate, I came upon the graduate writing program at a place called Naropa Institute. So Naropa Institute started in the 1970s and was founded by a Tibetan Buddhist Lama, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, along with the beat poets Allen Ginsberg and Anne Waldman. They were specifically involved in the establishing and building of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, which is specifically where I went to study. But they were housed within this larger Buddhist institution that was very interested in the convergence of like Eastern and Western cultures and wisdoms and practices, basically. Part of our requirement at that time when I was a student is that we had to take certain number of credits or classes in contemplative study. Some people did yoga, some people did like Zen archery, flower arranging, meditation. Some of those things interested me, some of them didn't. But what I was interested in was a practice called Chanoyu, which is Japanese tea. And Japanese tea is an aesthetic practice that brings together many different aesthetic practices that interest me. So at the heart of it, it is a tea ceremony that involves a host and a guest, you know, somebody who serves and somebody who receives this, you know, bowl of green matcha tea. But then there are all the kind of accoutrements and rituals and instruments that surround the actual practice of the tea. So, you know, when I say that, you know, there's a high level of aesthetics involved in this practice, the bowl, the vessel in which the tea is served is a beautiful hand-thrown ceramic piece. The teaspoon or scoop that is used to scoop the powdered tea out of the lacquered vessel, that's probably going to be some kind of hand-carved, you know, wooden spoon. When you enter the tea room, you bow and you look at the scroll that's been hung for the pleasure of the visitor that reflects the season that you're in. It might have some sort of calligraphy or some sort of painting, poetry that is sort of evocative of the particular event or the experience. And alongside that, hanging from the wall might be a vessel that holds flowers and grasses that have maybe been selected for the occasion. So you have all this sort of convergence of like all these different aesthetics. And what attracted me to tea as a practice more than, say, meditation, which happens on a cushion and there's no movement and you're not talking. And yes, you are in community together, but you're all being quiet together. The idea of tea that really attracted me to it is that it was very much about this kind of interaction or this relationship. And it's true that the kinds of conversations that you have in a tea room during a tea ceremony are rather circumscribed. You can talk about the implements, the dogu, or, you know, the different objects that you're examining and that are, you know, coming into your field of vision. There is a script that you follow. You're offered a sweet. You say thank you. You excuse yourself for eating before the person before you for taking a sweet. And when you receive your bowl of tea, you turn the bowl of tea so that the front of the bowl is actually facing away from you to acknowledge and to honor or to thank the person serving the bowl of tea to you. So it's a very ritualized practice. And that is something that appealed to me tremendously. So when I lived in Boulder, I took Japanese tea lessons with a teacher that lived off campus, and she was trained in a specific tea tradition called Omoto Senke, which was different than what was being practiced on the campus at Naropa. I studied with this teacher for maybe about, I think, 6 months or so. And over time, I didn't feel like it was a relationship that felt like it was the teacher that I needed at that time. I stopped taking lessons with that teacher and was really curious about the tea house on the campus of Naropa. it had existed for a long time, and I knew that there was a group of people that met there on Wednesdays, but I never seemed to be able to catch them, and I never seemed to be able to catch the teacher. But over time and persistence, I finally was able to connect to that teacher, Shoshana Cooper, and to take lessons at Naropa for the rest of the time I was there. And when I left Boulder to go on to art school in Chicago, I found myself a Japanese tea teacher in the same tradition as Shoshana, which is the Urasenki School of Tea, and studied with Sensei Ike Nakashima for about a year and a half during the time that I lived in Chicago. So that's a little bit about my experiences with Japanese tea. And I'd be happy to read to you the piece Stillness. And just to kind of place Stillness in the context of an essay and a larger body of work that I created, when I lived in Chicago, I spent a lot of time in a specific gallery in the Art Institute of Chicago. It is a gallery that was designed by an architect named Tadao Ando to specifically showcase some of the Japanese antiquities in the collections of the Art Institute. And so I'd spend a lot of time there. It was a very beautiful contemplative space that I found very inviting and meditative and reminded me of other places and helped me turn towards my own interiority. The lessons or the kinds of assignments that I would give to myself in the sequence of poems that I wrote over about 20 years was that every time that I would go into the specific gallery space, I would write a poem about whatever I was seeing or whoever was coming into the gallery and whatever I was experiencing. And sometimes the things that I would experience would be memories or connections to things outside this field or space of the gallery that reminded me of the tea room. Stillness. Columns you pass between, tower high as bamboo stalks grouped in a grove. A white-haired guide prompts school students to exit in silence now. This rawness in the back of the throat, heart leaping forward while the mind turns back to the cool darkness of a tea teacher's home on West Carmen Street. Monday nights, Gakusei wore woolen sweaters, stockings under ankle-length skirts, gathered neatly under knees. We knelt in practice, hot water, matcha, warming a bowl, the chill of the gallery dissipating.
I've wandered into a world with which I have absolutely no familiarity whatsoever. Well, we did some poems from Virga. Could you read Ashida no Yo garden poem?
Yeah, Ashida no Yo was a poem that was commissioned by the Kubota Garden Foundation. There is a Japanese-American garden here in Seattle that is a really important historic site. It was created by a Japanese-American immigrant, Fujitaro Kubota, who was able to cultivate the land. He wasn't able to originally buy this plot of land that would become this beautiful garden that he would develop because of racism, you know, policies, exclusion policies around Asians being able to own property during this period of time. So he was able to acquire it, I think, through the help of some friends. And during World War II, during the Japanese-American incarceration, he was removed from that property and, you know, it fell into disrepair. And when he came back, he had to work very hard to restore that garden to its former glory and brilliance. So it's a very important site in South Seattle. If you have the opportunity to visit it or to take a tour, it's an extraordinary place that emulates many of the characteristics and qualities of a traditional Japanese garden, but using Northwest materials and plantings. So it's extremely innovative and unusual and is hard to think of fully in the context of just being a purely Japanese garden. Ashide no Yo, garden poem. An eastern red-eared terrapin turtle moves with the pace of stone. The long crawl out of Lake Washington into the daylight of Mapes Creek, sight of an old stump farm, awakening a memory of land, clear cut and harvested in the time of the Heian. To imagine a woodland forest where one was once removed, transformed by rock, stood upright to impart the heart spirit, horsetail rushes embedded in a boulder 4 billion years ago. Permutations of the natural order flow through weeping spruce. There, in the cataract of blue atlas, water slapping against stone. An orange koi glides alongside a choir of black carp, the bronze bell still throbbing.
So are the koi and the carp and the bell, are they part of the garden?
Yes, they are. It's the Kubota Garden. It's in the Rainier Beach neighborhood, in the most diverse neighborhood of Seattle, in the 98118.
What is the time of the Heian?
That's a historic period in Japanese history, kind of like the golden age of poetry and culture in Japan.
So what is the use of that time period in the poem? Were you referring to the way that the garden was put together? Was that it was like it was from that time, or?
Yeah, you know, the kinds of aesthetics and practices that were present in that particular period in shaping and informing the kinds of landscape architecture that you might see in a Japanese garden. Exactly.
Okay. Homeomorphic. I picked out that poem. Could you read that for us?
There are poems like White Saber Industrial Complex and, you know, Chiang Kai-shek Boneyard that also look at place, but through the lens of kind of wanting to better understand or critique history. But the piece that you're talking about, Homeomorphic, it's actually one of a sequence of poems that's actually written after the work of Richard Serra from the Olympic Sculpture Park in the Seattle Art Museum. So Homeomorphic is the second piece in the sequence. Homeomorphic, a torus is just a donut pulled out of the geometry of coffee mug, the ambient space of deformation. A ship's hull shrinks down into a pillow-shaped hard candy, thread of sugar stretching into the hollow barrel of a tube of pasta. So this sequence of poems is about the Richard Serra sculptures that are kind of planted in the sculpture garden, not far from, you know, the waterline. It's just kind of a meditation on those shapes and those sculptures. And there's a large body of my work that's about reflecting on, responding to the visual arts. And somebody had asked me to write some poems specifically related to some of the images that I've seen made about Richard Serra's work. And so that's the kind of background for those poems.
So that's kind of like ekphrastic. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you just pick out something that you'd like to read and read it for us?
This is another ekphrastic poem. This is called Instructions for Making Earthworks After Viewing Andy Goldsworthy. As beings that live upon this earth, we are learning to relate to place. Leave a mark that's made without the use of harm, rather than hack into bark or drawing into sand. Leave an artifact behind. Something gathered from the land to add to what is a ready whole, a corona of flower petals, a snaking line of fallen logs, a row of stones curling into spiral.
Upaya.
Yeah, so Upaya is a poem that I wrote during pandemic after the period of spike and rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, particularly towards women. That has been something that has been persistent since the days before pandemic, probably, but were exacerbated by the rhetoric around coronavirus and its supposed origins. And it escalated a lot of danger for people who look like me. And so this poem is specifically about those experiences. Upaya is the Sanskrit word for expedient means, and one might regard it as a way of thinking about speech, but in Buddhist teachings, there's this notion of expedient means or a particular kind of language in which the teaching needs to be delivered so that the receiver is able to hear it and take it in. So that's what upaya means. Upaya. We have loved each other long enough that what I don't say still echoes in the mind. I am so bored of raising facts, stabbings, shootings, assaults. My husband knows better than to tell me what to do. Speaks his care so that I don't have to eat my fear of going alone to the grocery store. I have choices like that day 1 month ago when I asked my son to please stop telling people we are Chinese.
I would like for you to read another poem or two about being a mother. I thought that was a really nice part of the book.
Yeah, I'm happy to wrap up by talking and reading from a couple of poems about mothering and being a parent. I think what I do want to say about Upaya is that it's a very complicated poem. It's about learning at a very young age to hide your identity, to hide who you are. And that's not something that I was able to do, being somebody who presents as being East Asian, but my son is actually mixed race. So he is white passing. And so in that way, he has a way in which he can move through the world undetected in a way that I cannot. And so this poem is about learning to code switch. I think with it, it's complicated because certainly I don't want him to ever carry shame about his heritage. And yet to choose to not put that front facing is important to the interest of one's own survival on this planet sometimes. So I'll read two poems. Marine Science Center, Port Townsend. After an hour of exploring indoor touch tanks with our son, my husband signals he's ready to move on, though our two-year-old lingers and ready to plunge a hand into cold pools or to go home. He'd held back my husband's hand from touching the spiked orange sea cucumber, buried his face in our arms when a crab sidestepped nearer, but regarded the colorful feather duster worms with a closer curiosity that made me question the urge to survive. Instincts that no longer serve a purpose yet keep us from pushing out beyond the comfort of the cocoon. Hands clasped together, I watched him ease our child's palm into seawater to come into contact with the purple tentacled tube worms, fan-shaped appendages pulled back in a flash. Fear transforms into surprise, delight repeating itself again and again as our son grows bolder with each reach. First grade math. My six-year-old's brain is broken by the equation heart plus 3 equals 14. To solve for heart, 7x like a treasure map, his father gives an analogy with cookies. As I observe the confusion multiply in my son's speech. Because love is another language, because heart is not a fixed number, because my love for you is infinite.
Well, thank you very much for doing this, Shinyi. You've been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH. We've been talking to Shinyi Pai, the Seattle poet. And thanks again, Shinyi, for coming to Sound Poetry.
You bet. Thanks for having me on the show, Steve.